Natural Solutions with Dr. J, your source for time-tested and cutting-edge natural medicine approaches to optimize your health, with your host, Dr. J. Sordian.
Code blue in the White House. Would successful presidents sell voters to win elections? Chapter 5, American Voter 101. Our human brain has higher levels of functioning than the survival brain. The neocortex exemplifies this higher level of operation. There are various ways that our brain has categorized information. Those categories tell us things like who to trust, who to avoid, what to choose, what to reject, and millions of other judgments and interpretations. In this chapter, I'm going to go over some of the more key concepts and opposites that play into the decision-making process of the voter in choosing who to vote for. Part of these are related to our tribal orientation as humans. Part of these are related to our sense of safety or our willingness to take risk. And still others are related to rights of the individual in conjunction with obligations of the collective. The above survival aspects of American voter psychology include freedom of speech, freedom of religion, rugged individualism, dreams of riches, freedom to go into any job you want and can get or create, helping others, supporting the family, winning, democracy, privacy, and private property. How you are related to the box, and where do you fit in the box? Certain people act and think within the box. They follow rules and get upset when others don't follow the rules. People in the military follow orders. People working on the job at a fast food store have particular rules and processes they follow to make the food consistent day in and day out. Workers who assemble computer components, formulate medications in a pharmaceutical factory, and put together automobiles alongside the robots, all have a set of rules and steps they follow to create the right product that can be replicated. This mindset and behavior is called the blueprint type in the bank code system, and most likely the C in the DISC system. By necessity and circumstance, we all need to work within the box in various situations. Without it, societies would not function very efficiently. In fact, without it, there would be no society. Bus, train, and air schedules would be way off. There are steps that have to be taken for a law to be passed by Congress. There are steps that have to be taken before soldiers are sent off to fight. There are steps involved in choosing and electing a president. Following the rules helps prevent chaos and creates greater predictability. On the other hand, it can also stifle innovation. Nevertheless, it is important that at least part of the population be working within the box all the time, and everyone else working within the box at least part of the time. Other people are considered to be operating, quote, outside the box, unquote. Donald Trump even wrote a book about being outside the box. Bernie Sanders is also not your mainstream politician in his philosophy and stances. Both might be considered to be operating outside the box. The irony comes into play by realizing that once you are elected president, you are firmly inside a predetermined role that has certain roles and protocols you are expected to follow. That position is controlled by a 200-plus-year-old tradition that is being inside a box as a blueprint, a B-type role. You become a code blue in the White House. Insider or outsider? Inside the Beltway, Washington, D.C., or outside political arenas? Politicians love to have a me versus them object. Who can they point to distinguish themselves from? Who can I point to as the bad or incompetent one so that I am, by comparison, great and competent? For people who are in or work with the federal government, their lingo includes the term inside the beltway. What does that mean? In essence, this means the federal government, White House, Congress, departments, and agencies. Because they are located inside the highway, the beltway, that goes around Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia, an area of land that is the land of the U.S. government. People who work inside the beltway are the ones who make the federal laws and enforce or carry them out. Of course, there are other large agencies like the CIA and the Pentagon, which are outside the beltway. So, anytime there is gridlock in Congress, when the two major parties can't agree on something or on anything, and it seems that there are problems resulting from that, even the politicians who are part of the gridlock will claim to be outside the beltway. That way, the troublemakers, the no-gooders, the obstructionists, the them are the other people inside the beltway. This insider slash outsider dichotomy, gambit, is played by many current candidates, like governors, and particularly by Donald Trump, who has never worked as a government employee inside the beltway. Some voters hate the federal government so much that anyone outside the beltway already has instant credibility. And given that the creation of the United States of America is based on a rebellion against another government and taxation, actually it was corporate favoritism in tax structure, not simply taxation, this antipathy to the federal government is somewhat ingrained in what it means to be an American. Thus, by design, insiders to the Beltway are at least a little bit suspect by definition. Immigrants versus native-born. Modern America, or properly called the United States of America, is a nation of immigrants. Even the Native Americans are immigrants from another continent, according to anthropologists. Of course, though, the Native American tribes existed here long before the European explorers came to, quote, unquote, discover these lands and bring a new way to steward the land and animals through land ownership. Waves of immigration from around the world are the legacy of this land mass. Sequestering Native American tribes into their own tracts of lands and separate and semi-autonomous states is also a legacy. And along the way, many people have been born to parents who were birthing while on this landmass. So there's a mixture of immigrant and native-born peoples living here together. It has always been that way for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. People born on this landmass, the, quote, native-born, have a feeling of specialness. This is not unlike the feeling people born in other countries feel. One's native village is a deep-seated psychological construct of the brain that is intrinsic and thus very powerful. Public and private and home-based education have an influence on this feeling in the individual. Sometimes it enhances it. Those people are very patriotic and feel a deep loyalty to the native village, hometown, state I was born and reared in, my country 'tis of thee. Teaching the history of a country in standard school curriculum binds all peoples in the country to a common feeling of ties and patriotism. On the other hand, recent immigrants and children of recent immigrants, but native born, may have very close cultural ties to the country of origin of the immigrants. These deep cultural ties, language, holidays, religious practices and beliefs, all can temper the feelings of patriotism for the new country. And they can also create a conflict in the new native-born person's mind. Maybe they exist with the split cultural loyalty, or they never embrace the new cultural identity as an American, and instead identify with their parents' homeland. The past 40 years or more have also been a time when discovering and respecting your roots has been an important part of personal and family growth for many Americans. And of course, there's the question of what really is authentic, quote unquote, American culture. Given the melting pot theme, imagine the difference between a pureed vegetable soup to a stew. American culture is more like a stew, while French or German cultures are more like a pureed vegetable soup. Although that homogeneity of culture has broken down in the past decades more and more. The American melting pot stew is a soup with lots of still clearly identifiable, fully formed chunks of food mixed in with each other. The pieces of the stew, vegetables, spices, meat slash tofu slash veggie beef, whatever, bump up against each other and create a culinary delight, but each flavor is still identifiable and strong. On the other stove burner, the pureed vegetable soup has all the components so blended that there is a predominant flavor and texture that is distinct. It is also a wonderful thing to imbibe and enjoy. But it is a different way to make an edible. So when politicians try to use this immigration versus native-born concept as a political hot button, they will open up some deep psychological and cultural responses. For some of the more patriotic America for Americans type of voters, this topic may spur them to attend rallies and speeches and give money. These voters may view things more in two choices, two contrasts, black versus white, or black and white, not 50 shades of gray. However, for others, the issue is more complex. Using the immigration issue, legal or otherwise, to drum up personal support will only confuse them. For them, immigration is not a black or white issue, and mention of building a wall creates an opposite response or a confused thought. In sales, a confused thought is a person who will not buy. A wall means to some, vote yes. To others, it means, I'm on the other side of the issue and don't want a wall between me and my dreams. Nevertheless, immigration is a hot-button concept in human psychology and is thus one tool in the politician's or candidate's toolbox of building blocks to try to construct their vote-getting machine. Individuals versus society and government. One key idea typically associated with Americanism is individualism. Standing on your own two feet, being a self-made man or woman. The stories of the pre-colonial era are rife with the explorers of the continent who were alone or in small teams mapping out the territory and meeting the native tribes to learn more and trade goods. This idea of going it alone is certainly based on some aspects of human psychology. We are born into this world usually alone, unless we are a twin, triplet, quadruplet, quintuplet, or dot, dot, dot. In school, we are having to memorize things into our own individual head. We move around as an individual being. We have an individual name. Some cultures may not have this, but in American culture, we have an individualizing name. We get a social security number that is unique to each of us. We each have to put food and liquids down our own mouth to get nourishment, etc., etc. So, biologically, psychologically, and culturally, we have a certain emphasis on the individual as an American. Even the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights of the Constitution put this individualism into the legal and common law foundation of how we are to operate in this country. Duty to society is also part of our American upbringing and cultural education. Certain of the Bill of Rights, constitutional amendments, have been modified by the court rulings to temper individual rights with the needs of society. For example, the First Amendment, freedom of speech, is modified such that you can't shout fire in a crowded theater if it is not true. The individual rights mitigate it for the good of society as a whole. Nevertheless, individual freedoms are so ingrained into the social psychology of the American voter's mind, when a politician speaks to loss of individual freedoms, that kicks up an awakened diligence response, much like a survival fight or flight response in many voters. Then, the next thing said will slide more easily into the person's brain as acceptable and a valid interpretation of the situation at hand. Note that I am saying that the mere mention of the terms freedom or restrictions on freedom shift the brain into an unconscious fear / survival mode at the deep brain level. Then the rational mind kicks in, and the next thing a politician may say has a better chance of being accepted as true. When you read the text of the Ted Cruz speech at Liberty University later in this book, you will see how often applause responses occur. Staged or not, these applause responses are an emotional outburst and reaction that warms the potential voter to like the speaker. If not forever, at least for a short time. Both Ted Cruz and Donald Trump use this phraseology over and over again, as if by saying it, it makes them more American than others, more trustworthy than others, more presidential than those who don't say it over and over again. Listen to the presidential speeches from the Oval Office. For decades, the ending of almost all of those speeches invoke freedom and the blessings of God on the American people. Say the same thing as a candidate, and you sound more presidential. If the person or voter listening actually listens to any presidential speeches, invoking what you can do for society and societal obligations are also a part of American education, and even part of the brain's structure. After all, we are all social and tribal beings. President John F. Kennedy's famous line, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country," is the gold standard for the president invoking societal obligation and patriotism. Asking the American voter to help society, to volunteer for the good of the country, can motivate some voters. But I think that it is not as strong of a sales hook as the former part of the phrase, "ask not what your country can do for you," because by removing the "not," we are back to the very powerful radio station, WIFM. Individualism and self-preservation and self-interest are stronger motivations for most people than is helping the community. However, this statement assumes that the voter is not a nurturing type. More on this later in the book when discussing the bank code personality typing system. You can get a hint about this topic by going to www.4-cards.com. FOUR-CARDS.com and play the bank code card game, or by looking on page 17 of the white paper confirming the validity of the bank code personality coding system. You can also get a copy of the executive summary of the white paper at www.4-cards.com. Individual responsibility versus teamwork. Politicians will invoke individual freedom first, and then they will tout the virtues of individual responsibility if they are speaking to a target audience who believes that people need to pick themselves up by the bootstraps. Voters who think that getting a hand up is a sign of weakness, and who think that food stamps, welfare assistance, social security checks, Medicare, and other forms of federal assistance as negative, will respond positively to this invocation of the term individual responsibility. Granted that we all have individual responsibility for many aspects of our life. We put things in our mouths. We say things. We do things to others. American society says that is both our freedom, but also our responsibility when it comes to the law and criminal actions. However, none of us are born spontaneously. It is a team effort. What do I mean by that? Getting the food we eat is largely a group and team effort. The products we use and rely on, transportation, clothing, shelter, workplace, computers, cell phones, etc., are a result of teamwork. And many people going to school or university are there because of scholarships or grants. This is teamwork and also charity from others. In the arena of politics, though, calls for teamwork, charity, community effort, inclusiveness is made by candidates who believe in teamwork and know that nothing is done in a vacuum. Bernie Sanders has been a vocal advocate of this, whereas Donald Trump has been more of the individual responsibility type of candidate. What do we make of the book that Hillary Clinton wrote, With Help? It takes a village. This is also emphasizing the teamwork angle. On the other hand, some politicians will emphasize the many eyes versus the team idea, that it is the individual who is important in the team and not the synergism. This is more the A type in bank code. Other concepts that are subtly promoted in political speeches are the I versus us, us versus them, and personal interests versus big picture thinking. This is weighing in on the individualism construct as being most important and placing the value of other people lower on the neuropsychosocial hierarchy of importance. This neuropsychosocial hierarchy is as follows. It starts with ME, me. It then turns to US, us, the plural of me. Then to the team, which is me and others. And then to them slash others, the not me or us. This is another way of saying that everyone listens first to WIFM. Later on, if they mature in their listening behaviors, they graduate on to WIFU, WIFT, and WIFO. What's in it for others, and how can I help them? Individual responsibility versus collective cooperation. This subtitle is just another way of phrasing the dichotomies of individual versus society, individual versus government, and individual responsibility versus teamwork. Thankfully, I have already addressed this previously. Aren't you relieved to not have yet another overly pedantic faux academic diatribe to decipher? By the way, politicians try to use small words aimed at the sixth grader education level. That is because they don't want to lose your attention on a word you may not know. When you don't know a word, you start to focus on that word to figure it out. Thus, you are no longer listening to them, and they want to be in control of the conversation. So you'll never hear them talking about things like anti-disestablishmentarianism, values versus policy. All humans individually and as a culture hold certain values. The greater the commonality, the greater the cohesiveness of the culture. The more diverse the values held and practiced, the more potential for conflict, but also perhaps greater innovation. The population of the United States has a huge diversity of religions, races, countries of origin, and native tongues. Even the Native American population is diverse in culture and language. How does a politician speak to the diversity of his or her constituents and still get elected? Once again, the most persuasive political candidates know how to sell. Politicians have sales acumen as their currency. The sales may be fundraising abilities, creating teams of people who will volunteer for them, or of captivating the imagination of the party machinery. But they always have to be selling to survive in politics. Did you catch that I said this before? I did, because it is important to understand. Sales have to occur to win an election. You have to show that you, as the candidate, have sufficient value to the voter for her or him to take the time to vote. So, value here refers to the value of the candidate to the voter. Another meaning of values is illustrated by the following words that people believe in: freedom, independence, individualism, charity, education, integrity, personal growth, trust in relationships, fairness, consistency, loyalty, religious beliefs, including having no religious belief, pursuit of happiness, privacy, etc. Values are beliefs that are important to people and guide them in their behavior and decision making. Values and beliefs are so deeply integrated into a person's personality that politicians know that speaking to a person's values, as well as to their fears and aspirations, is the way to a person's heart, vote, and even pocketbook. Policies are the principles that will guide a candidate in deciding how to carry out activities in a consistent and step-by-step fashion. Policies imply continuity, not arbitrarily. But policies are less immediate to most voters. Values, which evoke a deeper emotional response, are a more immediate channel to winning over a voter. Policies are more logic and rationality based. Values are more emotionally based. The old maxim goes, emotion sells and logic justifies the purchase or choice. So a successful candidate pushes emotional buttons first and then follows it up with a little rationality. Values can be divisive, but when a candidate chooses a universal value like survival, everyone listens even if they don't want to. If the candidate chooses a less basic survival value, like personal growth or consistency, they will be speaking to a smaller part of the population. Their voting base has narrowed, but they don't have to get 100% of the ears at any one time to win the election. The three H's. Americans vote with their heads, hearts, and hopes. The so-called three H's. This is not to be confused with the venerable four H clubs of agricultural America. No matter what they may say during presidential primary or general election polls, in the voting booth, voters ultimately have to make a decision, and that usually is based on values. Values are based on beliefs, and beliefs are based on feelings and thoughts. So, when a voter doesn't have a candidate choice on the ballot who they clearly like, they have to prioritize and choose the lesser of two or more evils. Which one do you despise less? Which one is not as bad? Which one doesn't turn your stomach as much? Face it, voter. Either you hold your nose and vote anyway, or you make a choice and do not vote for either or any candidate. You choose by not choosing, by skipping that checkbox, lever, or Chad. One reason for this dilemma is the fact that ranked voting is not instituted in the U.S. body politic. In other words, you can't rank your choices from 1 to 5 with your ability to really vote for who you want to win put at 1. Then you rank on down in choices. The dilemma of having to make a yes-no vote is that if you vote only for the dark horse candidate, you might ultimately end up allowing someone else to win who you want to strongly vote against. In short, many people don't vote in presidential and other elections because ranked voting does not exist in almost all U.S. elections. Why not, you ask? Because the political parties are dead set against this in almost every election cycle, precisely because they know that third or fourth party candidates would get so many more votes. This would show the weakness of the two major parties. And so the Democratic and Republican parties can't allow their power to be eroded. The two major political parties will do anything to prevent an erosion of their power, even if that means creating an apathetic electorate. Political pundits claim that the electorate, the eligible voters, don't vote because they are apathetic and just don't care. The reality is quite the opposite. Voters care so much, they vote by not voting. It may sound like a contradiction, but they cast a vote of no confidence by saying, "I don't think my vote counts anyway, so I will not take the time or effort to cast a ballot for candidates I don't believe in." The bottom line in this section on values versus policy is this. Voters have feelings about political candidates. The feelings create beliefs. The beliefs are the basis of values. And the voter looks at the political candidates or politicians, and then they judge what that person's values really are. And then they vote based on their perception of values, personality, integrity, intelligence, honesty, etc., that those candidates display. Various miscellaneous other determinants of voting. Other political psychology factors that play into deciding what the candidate's values are include what policies they espouse, what policies they have historically supported, their historical record regarding jobs, crimes, marriages, children, divorce, and scandals, content of previous speeches, mea culpas, what their party is and which faction of the party they align with, if any, their other actions in life, how they look, how they dress, how they carry themselves, how tall they are, how does their voice sound? Do they want to listen to that voice for 4 to 8 years? What color their skin is? What they say their religion is or isn't, etc., etc. Addressing the reptilian in us all, the survival brain, food, clothing, and shelter. Once again, we are touching on the survival brain, the so-called reptilian brain, because even reptiles have this kind of a brain / nervous system structure. Don't think that I am calling humans or Americans snakes, crocodiles, or turtles. It is simply that all of us, including the homeless, hungry, and, quote, shabbily dressed, need the basics that are taught to all elementary school children in geography or social studies. The big three survival basics: food, clothing, and shelter. People need some way to get cash flow or economic exchange for that to happen. It doesn't happen anymore just living off the land. So some might include that needing a job for all of the above is number four in the survival basics list. Without a means of producing some cash flow, poverty, unemployment, high debt load, etc., are the results. Thus, these are the topics that politicians speak about and make promises to address to the voters. Whether you paint a pretty picture of the dream you will fulfill for the American worker or the debt-riddled university graduate, or you say that you will make America great again, vague terms or specific policies and plans are the tellings that politicians say to address the survival brain of the voters. Thus, these are topics that politicians speak about and make promises to address to the voters. Whether you paint a pretty picture of the dream you will fulfill for the American worker or the debt-riddled university graduate, or you say that you will make America great again, vague terms or specific policies and plans are the tellings that politicians say to address the survival brain of the voters. Fear versus confidence. People respond to confidence. They often follow a leader, even on a hike with friends, if that person seems more confident than they are. Scare them and show them you are confident. Trigger the fear/survival response mechanism, and then engage the tribal need/belonging part of the brain. Shower them with flowering generalities of a better tomorrow. It is surprising how often it works, at least in the short term. Do it often enough, and maybe they will vote for you on election day. Some people also may have heard me say, confidence is a placebo for rational observation. This also works when starting with fear and then invoking ideas of freedom, individuality, and even charity. Adding in the element of competition with the quote-unquote enemy and the need to win also touches on the survival instincts, making the issue of friends or foe dichotomy can also be a very effective entry into the support psychology of the voter. Recognizing threats, creating false threats and false enemies. Once again, the same old theme. Induce fear, even if you know it is false. Then point to the supposed perpetrator of the threat to take the heat off yourself. A serious case in point was the weapons of mass destruction argument that George W. Bush administration had Secretary of Defense Colin Powell push on the United Nations. There were those who knew this to be false, but it was pushed and resulted in untold misery, death, and destruction in Iraq and other parts of the world. The emergence of ISIS being a likely result of destabilization induced by invasion and dismantlement of Iraq's dictatorship. Next chapter is chapter 6, Archetypes to Understand Human Behavior and Then Speak to It. You have been listening to another chapter out of the book, Code Blue in the White House. The successful presidents sell voters to win elections. You can buy your own copy of this book on Kindle or on Amazon by going to the website www.codebluein-the-white-house.com. That's codebluein-the-white-house.com.
and continue listening to Natural Solutions with Dr. J. You will be able to hear other chapters out of this book, as well as other chapters read from the book Super Brain, Maximize Your Brain Health for a Better Life, and Outsmarting the Dementia Epidemic. We also have very interesting interviews with a wide variety of individuals across the professional spectrum, talking about dementia, talking about your brain, talking about health, and a wide variety of other topics that we feel will benefit you both in your physical, mental, spiritual, and emotional health arenas. This is Dr. J. Sordian wishing you a great day and looking forward to speaking to you again in the near future.